From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
You could call the first Gulf War the CNN war as we saw it unfold basically live on television, right? And I think these wars are the YouTube wars.
Deborah Scranton directed The War Tapes, the best documentary from the Tribeca Film Festival, which has just come out on DVD. We'll talk with her in just a minute as we focus this hour on leadership in war. We'll also remember the extraordinary wartime leadership of Winston Churchill and get the bard's take on rulers from Shakespeare expert Stephen Greenblatt.
Shakespeare has very few deep reflections on what it is to rule, but one of his absolute consistent ones is he thought that ruling meant sleeplessness. He would have found extremely implausible that you could get a decent night's sleep, let alone take a long vacation, in command of a country, let alone a country at war.
The war in Iraq has been going on for years. Deborah Scranton watches the news. She thought she was well informed. Then she started watching videotapes shot by National Guard soldiers deployed in Iraq.
I had heard stories about it, but when I got those tapes and put them in the deck and heard it and heard guys who I knew yelling and screaming and the chaos, it was really overwhelming.
Did anybody clear those rooms yet? Okay.
Go through your mind, is today the day? Are they going to get hit? Are they going to be okay? Are they back safely within the wire? I mean, my computer was on 24/7. You know, my IM windows were always open. It was very nerve-wracking.
Deborah Scranton turned the video she received from the soldiers into a film called The War Tapes, which is racking up best documentary awards at festivals all over the world. Scranton is the film's director, and she insists The War Tapes tells its story without spin.
It was filmed by the soldiers themselves on the front lines. They mounted the cameras, you know, on the dashboards of the Humvees, on the gun turrets, in other places as well. And it really gives you a view through their eyes as their experience unfolded, what it looked like.
How did you get this set up? How did this film get made?
Based on an earlier film I had made on World War II vets from my small town, the New Hampshire National Guard, Major Greg Hileshorn, who's the public affairs officer for the New Hampshire National Guard, called me with an offer to embed in any of the units that were deploying for OIF-2 in 2004. And my idea, literally, I went to sleep and woke up in the middle of the night with an idea of what if I were to, in effect, virtually embed and to give the soldiers cameras and work with them in a permeable relationship over the internet for the Iraq portion. Because what I really wanted to do was to crawl inside the experience of war, to really understand, you know, what it looked like, smelled like, felt like, to see it through their eyes.
It is a big difference, isn't it? If you were to have gone with a camera and accompanied these guys, what got filmed and what got set probably would have been very different.
Yeah, definitely. I also think that my background in television, I had done a lot of sports work, so I was very comfortable with a multi-camera filming platform. And I think we increased the facets of what you can see by having two cameras in one vehicle, you know, one up on the turret and one down below in the vehicle. Plus, normally when the platforms would go out, when the Humvees would go out, there'd be at least three, if not six, in a convoy. So we could have, you know, at one point we had 21 cameras filming. So there could be out on, you know, on a mission, several cameras filming, which would all give you a different perspective that then could be cut together to give you a fuller view of what that day was like.
How did it get decided who was going to have the cameras?
Well, the caveat for my access was once I picked the unit, which was Charlie Company, 3rd of the 172nd, it's a mountain infantry, it's the only infantry unit in the state of New Hampshire. The caveat for my access was that I had to ask the soldiers to volunteer. So I went down to Fort Dix with my executive producer, Chuck Lacey, and a crew, and I hopped out in front of the unit, the 180 guys, and told them my vision, and I made them a promise. I said that we would tell the story wherever it took us, no matter what. And 10 soldiers stepped forward and volunteered to carry cameras and to work with me. And as I mentioned, in total, 21 soldiers filmed for the project. But 5 soldiers filmed the entire year. three that you meet in the film, Steve Pink, Mike Moriarty, and Zach Bozzi, and two others, Brandon Wilkins and Duncan Domi.
Did you feel as though everybody understood before they left what it was that you were expecting to get out of this? Did you have a kind of shared vision of what the film was going to be made up of when they came home?
No, because we had no way of knowing, you know, how it would work, what it was going to be like. I mean, when they left, things were pretty quiet. But basically, once they got there, if you go back and look at the headlines, all hell broke loose. I mean, that was the April uprising. That's when they hung those four contractors' bodies off the bridge in Fallujah. You know, the war was back on. And we had no way of knowing when they went over how much, you know, action they would see. And in effect, they had over 225 direct enemy engagements while they were there. They saw a lot of action.
Some of this film is just extraordinary. It's not what you see on the news. In fact, I was a little surprised that the Defense Department stuck to its deal with you because, as you say, things changed once they got over there. And this is, well, not everybody comes off as pristine in the end as maybe they wished they would.
Army truck drivers make $17,000 a year, you know, E5. So they outsource it, privatize, save the Army money, and now we pay KBR $120,000. Do the same job. KBR annoys me. I don't want to talk politics, but man, they got it good. Take every store in your town and let it all be run by one company. I mean, that's basically what they do. They have their hands in anything you can think of. KBR runs all our chow halls.
Today we're having Middle Eastern Swedish meatballs and Iraqi freedom fries.
Look at all these plates, huh?
To charge the military food, they're going to put out 4,000 plates times $28 a plate. So when people take two, because sometimes we take one and then we'll take one and put it on top to keep it warm, it's $56 KBR just charged the government.
Every war has got its own little term to dehumanize the other side. And we had gooks in Vietnam, and this war has Hajis. It becomes almost like a filler, you know. Anybody that's non-American almost becomes a Haji. It originated because a lot of the older men in the Arab cultures have been done their pilgrimage to Mecca, so when you come back, you become a Haji. So it's used by Arabs, for Arabs, as a term of respect, but somehow I don't think a U.S. soldier on a patrol is using it in that context.
The New Hampshire National Guard was very supportive of the project and were very committed, especially Major Heilshorn, to the soldiers being able to tell the story because they're the ones who are fighting and dying in our name, to help bridge the disconnect. Because I think one of the biggest issues we're facing right now is this disconnect between someone who knows a soldier and, you know, those who don't. And I think it's very, very important until we start seeing soldiers as our neighbors, as us. You know, it shouldn't be an us and them. It needs to be a we. I mean, back in World War II, there was the home front, there was the war front. You know, people had victory gardens. I mean, you can go for days in this country and not really know that there's a war going on. The most important thing is that, you know, wars are done and fought and won or lost by ordinary people. And it's my greatest hope that the war tapes will help to bridge that disconnect between those who know a soldier and those who don't. I would share just one story with you. When the film premiered at the Tribeca Film Festival, all five soldiers who filmed all year were there for the Q&A after. A woman got up and asked a question, and she said, you know, what can I do, what can we do to help soldiers? And they all had their comments, but Brandon Wilkins, who's a Down East Mainer, a man of few words, you know, very eloquently said, get to know one. And he's right. For me, the most memorable moment came when a soldier came up to me. Because usually at the Q&As, the soldiers who are in the audiences don't normally say anything. They wait until it's all over and they kind of hang back and then they'll come up to me. And I'm pretty sure that I know that they're the soldiers. And this one guy came up and he stood really close to me and looked down at me and I saw his eyes fill up. And I was like, it's okay. And he started out with, my gunner was throwing candy. And I knew exactly what he was going to say. And he said, you know, I haven't been able to tell my family yet that we hit and killed a kid. I'm a father. I have kids of my own. I'm afraid they're going to think I'm a monster. And he said, but after seeing your film, I'm going to bring my wife back and we're going to go see your film and I'm going to tell her. And It's moments like that, which is why I do what I do.
All of the soldiers who sent video to Deborah Scranton made it home. Some are working civilian jobs. One's writing a book. One signed up for redeployment and is now in Afghanistan. The War Tapes has just come out on DVD. Later this hour, we'll remember the contributions of America's most faithful allies, our own native peoples, and the terrible price they've paid for their service.
My tribe signed a peace and friendship treaty with the U.S. government in 1827, and we promised to come to the military assistance of the United States should they ever need us. And even though the U.S. has broken every treaty they ever signed with my tribe, we're still honoring our obligations.
For a long time, they used to have to wake me up with a broom because I'd come out of that bed, you know, ready to kill.
The New York Times Book Review hailed Martin Gilbert's mammoth biography of Winston Churchill as a triumph. The latest volume, Churchill in America, documents Churchill's lifelong relationship with his mother's native land and his nation's most important ally. That relationship never mattered more than during the Second World War. Martin Gilbert told Steve Paulson what made Churchill such a great war leader.
He had relatively clear and simple ideas. He had a clear sense of right and wrong. I mean, he had a high moral sense. He wasn't interested in politics as such. He didn't like to play politics, and therefore he didn't need to dissemble. He didn't need to pretend he was doing something for a reason other than the reason he was doing it.
That's a remarkable thing to say. He didn't like to play politics when he spent virtually his whole life in politics.
I prefer to think that he spent virtually his whole life in the parliamentary system, or indeed in Parliament. He didn't get on particularly well with the party leaders or the party system. And in every party in which he served, and he changed parties twice, he went his own way and as a result was out of office for many, many, many years. I mean, when he was actually at the height of his powers, mental and physical, there was no place for him in government because he didn't toe the party line.
Was this specifically because of his warnings about Germany?
Entirely.
So for much of the 30s then, there was, well, I guess the word would be appeasement. There was this general sense that England should not confront Germany.
Yes, I think that appeasement was always rather a positive thing in the minds of the British leaders, Stanley Baldwin and then Neville Chamberlain, who succeeded him. Both men didn't see appeasement as something to do with fear or to do with capitulation. They saw it as some means of having Anglo-German cooperation. So this wasn't craven obeisance, it wasn't fear, it was hope and enthusiasm. And Hitler and his government played on that.
Now, this was, of course, before the Holocaust. I mean, the evils of Hitler were not quite so apparent.
The evils were not so apparent, but what marked Churchill out is that from 1932, before Hitler came to power, and throughout the period 33 onwards, he warned that Nazism was evil, that it wasn't just a different form of political system. It was a racist and evil system, and that it would seek to conquer Europe, even conquer the world, and that the plight of the Jews in particular was going to be horrendous.
What General Vagon has called the Battle of France is over. The Battle of Britain is about to begin. Upon this battle depends the survival of Christian civilization. But if we fail, then the whole world, including the United States, including all that we have known and cared for, will sink into the abyss of a new dark age, made more sinister and perhaps more protracted by the lights of perverted science. Let us therefore brace ourselves to our duty, and so bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its commonwealths last for 1,000 years, men will still say, this was their finest hour.
The enemies of Britain were at their most strong, and indeed all Britain's allies were destroyed and defeated, and Hitler conquered Norway, Denmark, Belgium, Holland, France. And Hitler really had nothing to prevent him from invading Britain or conquering Britain or undermining British morale or physically destroying Britain by bombardment from the air, except this man who said, it doesn't matter whether we're destroyed or not. What matters is that we stand up for our values. At least give him a good run for his money. At least, you know, show that the democracy which we are and the human rights in which we believe have the power to defend themselves even against an overwhelming enemy.
Do you think most people in Britain in, let's say, 1940 and 41 assumed that Germany would defeat them?
They knew that Germany had the power to defeat them. And neither they nor Churchill himself knew how that defeat could be averted. But he said, let's try it, and they tried it. The public trusted him not to surrender unnecessarily. The public understood he will carry on for as long as it's possible to carry on, and we just have to hope, I suppose, for miracles. And there were various miracles, including the so-called miracle of Dunkirk, when hundreds of thousands of soldiers who were trapped and defeated managed to get off, managed to get back to Britain, of course, mostly without their equipments, which were left behind. But at least they were saved. Now, if for some reason they had been destroyed, if it hadn't been one of the calmest seas ever known in the North Sea, if it had been a rough sea, then they would have been lost. And perhaps the morale would have collapsed at that time. And people would have said, right, we've had enough. Churchill accepted that. And he always had one of his qualities in the war. It was a general quality. He believed in telling people the story as it was.
Our heavy bombers are striking nightly at the taproot of German mechanized power and have already inflicted serious damage upon the oil refineries on which the Nazi effort to dominate the world directly depends. We must expect that as soon as stability is reached on the Western Front, the bulk of that hideous apparatus of aggression, which dashed Holland into ruin and slavery in a few days, will be turned upon us. I'm sure I speak for all when I say we are ready to face it.
Which is not usually what we hear today, for instance. I mean, the way the war in Iraq is presented, for instance. I mean, we don't hear from our leaders about what's going wrong.
Well, you mentioned a point there which I think is also very important to Churchill's story. Leadership. He did lead. I mean, that was what he was capable of doing. Perhaps all his life had been a training for that, because he'd had many setbacks, he'd made many mistakes, he'd had many political setbacks, personal setbacks. But he was always prepared to give the lead. If you asked him a question, he'd give you an answer. People understood he is leading, he is trying to find a way out, a way forward. And that really was his great strength in 1940. People knew, well, this man is not going to be sort of hiding behind a curtain. He's not going to be asking other people, well, am I doing the right thing? He's going to find a way of leading. And people were prepared to follow him.
Well, it's interesting what you're saying, because in some ways, I guess, I would assume that the leader of a country has to rally the people of his country. I mean, what else is a leader supposed to do? And yet you're suggesting that Churchill did that, but a lot more. I mean, somehow the way he did that was extraordinary.
Yes. I mean, there is another factor in this, that normally you find yourself in a situation where, if you like, you're stuck with the leader. In other words, when 9/11 happened in the United States, there was already a leader, there was already a president, and he had to be a leader. You know, he could either be a good leader or a bad leader, but he was sort of in place. In the British case, in May 1940, he was chosen to lead in the most desperate time. And the other thing he did, which has, for example, not happened in the United States in either of your wars in Iraq, is that the first thing he did was to abolish party politics and create all-party governments.
Having received His Majesty's commission, I have formed an administration of men and women of every party and of almost every point of view. We have differed and quarreled in the past, but now one bond unites us all, to wage war until victory is won, and never to surrender ourselves to servitude and shame, whatever the cost and the agony may be.
In his governing cabinet, or whatever you call it in England, there were people of all parties?
People of all parties, and also people of no party, people of great quality. So if, for example, the current situation in Iraq, which is confronting America, if it is really a serious situation, and that may be a matter for debate, but if it's a really serious situation, then the equivalent of what Churchill did is that President Bush would bring in probably Clinton and Gore and three or four other leading Democrats, perhaps Senator Lieberman, and they would have equal power with Cheney and Rumsfeld and with the Republicans. And parties would simply cease to exist. Bush would say, right, I want the best people, you know, throughout the party spectrum. So it may be a question that the danger is not seen in America as being all that great, though it seems to me a crisis.
I think most people would say it's a crisis.
So then, you know, the equivalent of Churchill's leadership would be the president forming an all-party coalition. He would remain president, but Republicanism and Democrat, they wouldn't be in the equation. They wouldn't be of interest to anybody. And certainly you wouldn't appoint somebody to any post who was merely a friend or a crony or whatever. You would appoint the person who was absolutely across the political spectrum the best person for that post.
So you're saying that the fact that he did that, that he essentially abolished the political party system during the war, really made a difference in how the country responded.
It made an enormous difference, and it meant that you didn't have one whole segment of your society denied the right to be responsible for aspects of war policy or war making. That is an extraordinary feature when you think of it. After all, war isn't just about jobs for the party boys, and it certainly isn't about profit making for the arms manufacturers. Churchill was very conscious of that, and he tried to create a unity across the social spectrum. So when you had leading Labour Party figures in very high positions in the government, then the public could be more satisfied that this isn't going to be a sort of cronyism war or a profit-making war.
The latest volume of Martin Gilbert's biography of Winston Churchill is called Churchill and America. Gilbert spoke with Steve Paulson. While Winston Churchill led his nation against Nazi Germany, the war was raging just as fiercely in the Pacific. One of the Americans who raised the flag on Iwo Jima had a son who went on to write books. In Flags of Our Fathers, James Bradley told his father's story. Now, he's back with another.
At the moment my dad was helping to raise a flag on Mount Suribachi on Iwo Jima, on the very next island, American flyboys were being beheaded. And while everyone knows the flag-raising photo, just next door, nobody knows.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. James Bradley told the story of his father's heroic war service on Iwo Jima in his book Flags of Our Fathers. That book became the basis of Clint Eastwood's pair of movies, Flags of Our Fathers and Letters from Iwo Jima. So you might think, that settles that. Now the story's finally been told. But World War II still has secrets to give up. Right beside Iwo Jima, or Iwo To, as the Japanese have decided to call the island, is another island called Chichijima. James Bradley's been researching its past.
Chichijima had radio stations on it, and over a period of a year, aircraft carriers came into the vicinity and launched strikes against it.
What was their mission?
Their mission was to destroy the radio stations on two mountains on the island. Iwo Jima was valuable for its airfields. Chichijima next door was valuable for these radio stations that took messages from Tokyo, strengthened them, and then sent them out to the Pacific. So these flyboys were all from different aircraft carriers. But over a period of a year, a number were shot down, eight captured and beheaded.
You've talked to the Japanese who were involved as interrogators in this, some who were involved in the eventual fate of these flyers. Looking back on it now, it's almost an unfair question to ask, but how do they feel half a century later, looking back on what happened then?
You know, my father was forced to kill. My father was not a killer, and he was forced to kill. He was kill or be killed. All of the Japanese soldiers ordered to kill the flyboys on Chichijima refused. Refusing the emperor's order meant death. It was a very dangerous thing to refuse in the Japanese army. They all refused. They had to be threatened with death themselves before they would behead a flyboy. One of the guys who beheaded a flyboy committed suicide. Another one ran away and got out of his duty. I went back to Japan and interviewed a man who beheaded a flyboy. They had to do it. It was kill or be killed at the age of 19 or 20.
And talking to the Americans who were involved in the fighting in that part of the world, how did they view what the Japanese did to the American flyers who were captured?
You know, in my travels across the United States, I find that the Pacific vets are very settled on both sides of the Pacific. The Japanese vets understand the American boys didn't know Japanese and had to come over and kill them. And the Americans realized that the boys were in a situation called war. I mean, my dad had to go kill Japanese on Iwo Jima. When I landed in Japan as a student in 1974, I was thinking sushi or a date. It had nothing to do with what type of person I was. I was in a different situation than my dad. So within one family, my family, the Bradley family, my dad had to kill or be killed. And truly, I fell in love with Japanese. I took George Bush back to Chichijima. We shot a documentary. And here, his bombs were intended to kill Japanese. I united him with some of the Japanese he was trying to kill. These Japanese would have killed him if they got their hands on him. Now they're 78-year-old men with their arms around each other with tears in their eyes.
It's an astonishing world we live in, isn't
it? It makes you wonder, what is this hysteria we call war?
How did you learn what happened to them, finally? I know that there was a trial. Did it come out at the trial, what had happened to these boys?
What's very interesting about this story, you know, this is not us searching for lost flyboys and then we find the Japanese and convict them. It's a story of the Japanese soldiers very outraged at the behavior of their officers, telling the Americans that these officers ordered the beheading of these flyboys. If the Japanese soldiers had not been outraged and come forward, we would not know the story.
How do you decide whether to tell a story like that? On the one hand, the family has presumably come to terms with the death of a family member, and it's been half a century.
Well, first of all, I did the math and realized I did not have to confront any mothers. They're all dead. Number two, my dad was a funeral director, and I just thought, well, I was taught that everyone deserves a dignified burial. These guys, the truth isn't known. I also looked at my dad's picture. He's got a lot of honor because he happened to be in an accidental photo on Iwo Jima. Now there's 8 American boys on the next island who knelt down to die. They're heroes and nobody knows who they are. And then I thought, well, if this was my brother who died, would I want to know the facts no matter how gory? So I put that all together, called the families. There was shock, but now that they see the book, I'm getting the word healing from them in letters and conversations and emails. Look it, they never knew the true facts. They were given a cover story, but somehow it was psychically unsatisfying. Now that they know the truth, even this difficult truth, they're talking about their lost flyboy brothers for the first time in a different way, and the healing process has begun.
Have you ever received a satisfactory explanation for why the government decided not to tell this story?
Yes. It isn't the government so much as it's just you and me. You and I come across an atrocity, and you and I as just humans feel that the mothers should not know, and we stamp it secret. A Navy SEAL fell out of a helicopter and was mutilated on the ground by the Taliban. We have beautiful digital imagery of this kid being mutilated. You haven't seen it. The mother hasn't seen it. Do you want to deliver it to the mother?
James Bradley's book about the secrets of Chichijima is called Flyboys. So what do you think? Is it better to know the truth, even if it's a terrible truth? How much detail does the public have a right to know? Send us your thoughts through our website at ttbook.org. YouTube and instant messaging have brought a new urgency to frontline communications, but the moral issues faced by soldiers and rulers haven't changed all that much since Shakespeare's time. Stephen Greenblatt is one of the world's preeminent Shakespeare scholars. His biography called Will in the World, How Shakespeare Became Shakespeare, landed on several Best Book of the Year lists when it was published in 2004 and launched Greenblatt into the social stratosphere. Of course, as he told Steve Paulson, he'd already had occasion to trot out the tux.
Back in 1998, I was invited by a friend of mine, Robert Pinsky, who was serving at the time as Poet Laureate of the United States, to a poetry evening at the White House. And at that time, Clinton said his first introduction to poetry was being forced to memorize some passages from Macbeth in junior high school. He said that wasn't the most auspicious beginning to a political career, and we all laughed. And then in the receiving line, I went up to shake his hand. I found myself saying, "Don't you think, Mr. President, that Macbeth's a great play about someone who feels compelled to do things that he knows are politically and morally disastrous?" And Clinton looked at me and held my hand and said, "I think Macbeth's a great play about someone whose immense ambition has an ethically inadequate object." I was amazed by the quickness of that response. And I actually, when I recovered my equilibrium, which took me a second, I asked what seemed to me a very lame question because I couldn't think of what else to say. I said, "Do you still remember some of those lines you learned from Macbeth?" "Oh, sure," said Clinton. And he began to recite a soliloquy.
Oh, my goodness.
"If it be done when 'tis done, then 'twere well it were done quickly. If the assassination could trammel up the consequence and catch with her surcease success, that but this blow might be the be-all and the end-all, here but here upon this bank and shoal of time we'd jump the life to come." And there was actually more of it. He conjured up much more than I can remember. I went away thinking that Bill Clinton missed his true vocation, which was to be an English professor. But then because of that, I began actually to give some thought to this whole question that I took seriously that he raised of whether it's in Shakespeare, whether it's possible for anyone in Shakespeare to have immense ambition and an ethically adequate object of that ambition.
Well, and of course, in so many of Shakespeare's plays, there is a very up-close look at, well, at monarchy and at how this royalty does its job and, you know, whether it's doing a good job, whether these kings and queens are doing well.
I mean, what's interesting is that it's easy in Shakespeare to see, in the case of Shakespeare's villains, that there's something fundamentally wrong with all of their desires for power. What struck me as surprising when I began to think about it is that you couldn't actually look out beyond them to the good characters who have some ethically adequate ambition for their desire. They're all very complicated in relation to power.
Well, give me an example of that, how someone who does have tremendous power struggles with being a moral leader.
I mean, the first thing to say perhaps is that you don't see it very often in Shakespeare. That's surprising in some ways. You see a lot of characters wanting to pull back, characters who have morally complex natures wanting to get away from possessing power. But those people who actually sort of think about what it would be like to get it and have a moral nature, they come to grief, these characters, however much they have a kind of dream of getting a more decent relationship to authority.
How does he deal with the question of going into war, rallying the troops, sending people into battle to perhaps to their deaths? Is this a moral quandary?
Shakespeare represents it at various moments as a queasy decision that's made, but he tends to be, on the whole, not, how shall we say, a great admirer of going to war. But the consequence is to be very skeptical, I think, about the consequences of embarking on war, although also to understand the pressures. So in Henry V, Shakespeare shows that Henry V, who's come to power with a taint over his authority. It's not clear he should be king. His father had usurped the monarchy. He himself feels queasy about his possession of power. No one had very many expectations about him. He seems not to be fully in control of things. And what he does, of course, is partly through his own wishes and partly being manipulated by clever people around him, is he launches a war on the most absurd and flimsy of pretexts that everyone looking at them understands is fraudulent. He launches the country into a war that is extremely dangerous. And then Shakespeare represents extraordinary scenes in which people say, do you understand that we're going to die? You're responsible for our deaths. And Shakespeare represents Hal as simultaneously recognizing these charges against him and then turning it back to actually to a kind of limited negotiation with God to protect him in these matters. Shakespeare understood that rulers in these circumstances often wrap themselves in the language of theology.
Well, it's an interesting question whether rulers can really be so self-conscious about what they're doing. I mean, wouldn't they be paralyzed into inaction if they really thought through what all this means? I mean, all the people they are sending to their deaths.
I suppose it's the case that Shakespeare understood, as probably most of us understand, that people making decisions have to reach a certain point at which they cease to brood about them. On the other hand, Shakespeare has very few, consistent and deep reflections on what it is to rule. But one of his absolute consistent ones throughout his career is he thought that ruling meant sleeplessness, that you could not be a ruler without suffering from insomnia. He shows it again and again. He would have found extremely implausible that you could get a decent night's sleep, let alone take a long vacation, in a situation in which you were in command of a country, let alone a country at war. I mean, that absolutely consistent on his part. And the other thing he thinks, I think, very clearly, I think he has very few political principles. I think insomnia is one of them. And I think the other one that he comes back to over and over again is that the good things that you do in the world will not necessarily come back to you at all. You won't necessarily be rewarded for anything decent you do. But you can be absolutely confident that the rotten things you do will return and be visited upon you eventually, that you'll receive full payment in the rottenest sense for what you do in the world. You'll teach people how to do it to you. And that, I suppose, was a kind of a Shakespearean optimism of a sort. He didn't think that the punishment that you'd receive was going to be in the afterlife. There's no evidence that he thought that the whole thing was going to be sorted out in another world. He thought it was going to be sorted out, at least in the negative sense here, that you wouldn't make it over the long run.
But it sounds like you're also saying that at least for the leaders he considered to be good leaders, they had a strong conscience. I mean, they were going to be haunted by what they did.
Oh, I don't know if he thought that you would be haunted. He just thought you'd be screwed in the end if you screwed enough people.
Stephen Greenblatt is the author of Will in the World and many other books. Steve Paulson spoke with him. Professor Greenblatt blasted the legitimacy of Henry V's war against the French, but Shakespeare gave Hal what may be the greatest call to arms ever written. Here's Kenneth Branagh as Henry V.
Proclaim it, Westmoreland, through my host, that he which hath no stomach to this fight, let him depart. His passport shall be made, and crowns for convoy put into his purse. We would not die in that man's company that fears his fellowship to die with us. This day is called the Feast of Crispian. He that outlives this day and comes safe home will stand at tiptoe when this day is named and rouse him at the name of Crispian. He that shall see this day and live old age will yearly, on the vigil, feast his neighbors and say, tomorrow is St. Crispin's. Then will he strip his sleeve and show his scars and say, these wounds I had on Crispin's day. Old men forget, yet all shall be forgot, but he'll remember with advantages what feats he did that day. Then shall our names, familiar in their mouths as household words, Harry the King, Bedford and Exeter, Warwick and Talbot, Salisbury and Gloucester, be in their flowing cups freshly remembered. This story shall the good man teach his son, and Crispin Crispian shall ne'er go by from this day to the ending of the world, but we in it shall be remembered. We few, we happy few, we band of brothers, for he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother. Be he ne'er so vile, this day shall gentle his condition. And gentlemen in England now abed shall think themselves accursed they were not here, and hold their manhood's cheap, whilst any speaks
the thought with us upon St. Crispin's Day!
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. On some reservations, the military recruitment rate among young Native Americans reaches 70%. It's just one of the facts Wisconsin Public Television producer Patty Lowe uncovered for her documentary Way of the Warrior. Patty came over to our studio to tell Ann Strangechamps that her program began with her grandfather and his generation's experience of World War I.
He's put in a boarding school in Toma at the age of 6, where he gets up every morning at 5:30, and he's wearing a little woolen cadet uniform. He's got a little toy wooden rifle.
So these were really like little military academies.
They were. They marched to dormitory. They marched to their classrooms. They marched to the dining rooms.
So it must have been a very smooth segue to then enlist for World War
I. It really was. And these were such fertile grounds for recruitment. Plus, they offered $1 a month. So they became the first wave of the American Expeditionary Forces.
Could you paint a picture of what your grandfather's experience in combat was like? He served in the trenches, right?
He did. And I can give you a pretty descriptive answer because he kept a diary.
August 4th, 1918, got shelled on the road. Observation by a Boche balloon. Heavy casualties under severe shell fire. High explosives and gas. Lost my friend, Chubb. By shrapnel.
The young Native soldiers, were they completely accepted within the ranks of the military, or were they in any way treated like second-class citizens?
You know, it's interesting. They were treated differently because white military officers had stereotypic notions of who an Indian was and how they were oriented. They were considered super warriors. And so they were stereotyped in that way. And placed in the front lines, sometimes as shock troops.
So they were given the most dangerous assignments.
They were given the most dangerous assignments.
It's sort of a flattering stereotype, I suppose. They were considered these super amazing warriors, and at the same time, it's this stereotype.
Right, with consequences. You know, 5 times as many Native soldiers died during World War I than did troops in the general population of the American Expeditionary Forces.
How do you think that would have made a young Native soldier feel?
Part of those stereotypes were absorbed, and some of those stereotypes were assumed. You know, they've come out of, in some cases, especially in the plains areas, they've come out of this sort of really extreme warrior tradition. And it's been 30 years since they've had an opportunity to prove themselves in combat, which was part of their rite of passage. The U.S. military was really the only place where they could demonstrate their abilities as warriors. And so you have some men who are trying to prove themselves as warriors so that they come back to their communities and they achieve that status, that warrior status.
There are some who did, who are still revered, some World War II veterans.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, tell some of the stories because you uncovered some amazing stories.
Well, the story of Joe Medicine Crow. Joe Medicine Crow was an extremely well-educated Indian for his time. He was actually a dissertator at UCLA in the late 30s. And because of economics, he couldn't continue. And Medicine Crow wound up enlisting in the military. And you'd think that somebody with, 16 years of formal education would be put in a backroom plotting strategy. But no, he winds up on the front lines in the 101st Cactus Division, which was the division tasked with breaking through the Siegfried Line. Well, on the way to that task, there are 12 SS officers holed up in a farmhouse in the Italian countryside, and his platoon is told to capture them. There's a Pawnee fellow in Medicine Crow's platoon, and they approach this farmhouse, and they see that there are horses tethered out in front. Well, now, Medicine Crow, the Crow, and the Pawnee part of their rite of passage is you steal horses. So the two of them look at each other and say, we'll go get the horses. So they sneak up, they get the horses, and then, you know, there's this assault on the farmhouse. It winds up in hand-to-hand combat. And in the course of this hand-to-hand combat, Medicine Crow takes a service revolver from one of these officers, hits him over the head with it, knocks him out, doesn't kill him. But when he wakes up, he marches him back. The operation is a success. They get back to their platoon and all is well. Well, Medicine Crow goes back to his community after the war, and in the tradition of the Crow, is asked to appear before the Council of Elders and tell his war exploits. So he tells the story, and they all stand up and say, congratulations, we haven't had a war chief in, you know, how many decades, but you're our new war chief because you've done the four deeds necessary to achieve that status. You've stolen the enemy's horses. You've encountered the enemy and touched him. You've stolen his weapon, and you've captured him and brought him, you know, back alive. So talk about an anachronistic kind of experience, but he was a war chief because of this unusual experience during World War II.
So Native people have served in, it sounds like, just about almost all of this country's major
all
wars.
Yes, World War I, not almost all, every one.
Including Vietnam.
Including Vietnam, Desert Storm, Iraq.
Ogichida. I was born in war, WW2. Listened as the old men told stories of getting gassed in the trenches, WW1. Saw my uncles come back from Guadalcanal, North Africa, and the Battle of the Bulge. Memorized the war stories my cousins told of Korea. Felt the fear in their voices. Finally, it was my turn, my brother's too. Joined the Marines in time for the Cuban Missile Crisis. Heard the crack of rifles in the rice paddies south of Da Nang. Saw my friends die there, and tasted the bitterness of the only war America ever lost. My son is now a warrior. Will I listen to his stories or cry into his open grave?
What about when these soldiers come home? For instance, Vietnam, so many Vietnam veterans came home with terrible post-traumatic stress disorder. How has the Native community managed to reintegrate all of these Vietnam veterans?
This, to me, is the most interesting and intriguing aspect of the documentary. We, in mainstream society, send our soldiers to boot camp and training camps. We give them basic training, and we leave their spiritual preparation to the individual. In Native communities, there are formal protocols for preparing young men and now women for combat. They're given physical training, but they're also given spiritual training that's really handled on a community basis. And conversely, when they come back, in mainstream society, we just basically say, you know, hey, welcome back. You know, we're glad you made it.
You know,
here's some money for college, but that's pretty much it. We don't really pay attention to their psychological or spiritual needs. In every Native community I visited, there are formal protocols for reintegrating combat veterans back into society. In Hopi, and the Hopi just shudder when you say, you know, the word warrior, because they say, no, we're not warriors. We're people of peace. We pray every day for peace. But even they have formal protocols for reintegrating their warriors. When a veteran comes back to Hopi, they spend a period of time with the clan mothers telling their stories. And really, it's a group counseling session. It's intended to help them understand and process what they experienced. Then the clan mothers wash their hair in yucca leaves, and those veterans are given new names. In my community, when those veterans come back, they go through a sweat lodge ceremony, which is really symbolically re-entering Mother Earth and being reborn, purified, you know, with hot rocks, and the rocks are our grandfathers, and you are in the womb of Mother Earth, and the water is purifying you as it splashes hot against the rocks. And when you come out, when you crawl through the entrance to the sweat lodge, you are being reborn. And Native veterans repeatedly go through this ceremony. It's an ongoing process. They spend time with the elders, and they tell their stories, and they get psychological help. What's really interesting is, because of stereotypes, Native Americans still are in these most dangerous positions. So they're much more likely to see heavy to moderate combat than mainstream soldiers. And so they come back, having seen the horrors of war firsthand, close up, they come back with much higher incidences of post-traumatic stress disorder. But the soldiers that go back into communities that have these protocols and who participate in these ceremonies do much better with post-traumatic stress disorder. They heal much better. This, more than anything, is what I think Native America can help teach the U.S. military. We can't just let our soldiers come back and say, you know, oh, glad you didn't die, you know, get on with your life. We sent these soldiers out there as a community and asked them to assume this community obligation. We as a community have an obligation to those soldiers to help transform them from people of war to people of peace. It's not just for their own benefit, and this is something that Native communities seem to always have known. It's protecting the community from the poisons that the horrors of war have inflicted on the psyches of these soldiers, and we need to recognize that and help them deal with it.
An Indian Marine. I'm not Crazy Horse. I'm not Sitting Bull. I'm not Ira Hayes. I'm me. Being called Chief is not an honor like you think. Hey, do you know this guy? We used to call him Chief. He was Choctaw, Cherokee, Cheyenne, or something. I'm not a code talker. Your schools robbed me of the language I used to have. I'm no braver nor more of a coward than you. But when I took that green uniform off, I could be Indian again.
Way of the Warrior has been acquired by PBS for national release around Veterans Day. It was produced for Wisconsin Public Television by Patty Lowe, who talked with Ann Strangechamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you want to hear this program again, check an author's name, or find out about a piece of music we used, visit our website. It's www.ttbook.org. To buy a copy of the program, just call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 71A, Leadership in War. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Mary Lou Finnegan, with help from Ann Strangechamps, Doug Gordon, Veronica Rickert, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson.
PRI, Public Radio International.